You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello.
Big build-up for Daniel there. But Lionel...
Why?
Well, no reason, Daniel. That was a mistake. Because Lionel's the man who's just back from the Ardennes, aren't you, Lionel?
I am, indeed, yes. Making a Friends of the Podcast episode about the Ardennes races. Was going to call it Lionel of the Ardennes, but Simon came up with a better name. A pair of walloons.
Okay. Look forward to that. When's that going to be out?
Well, part one may well be out as I speak, because it's being polished now by our producer. And part two will come out probably middle of the week. So roughly speaking, split into Flesh Wallonne is covered in the first part, Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the second part. But it's there's not an awful lot of cycling in it, to be honest. It's about the place and the people and the culture.
You were getting under the skin, weren't you, of a place that we don't perhaps know so much about?
Trying to, yes, Rich. Yeah, I've puzzled really when I was totting up races I've been to over the years why it is that I've returned to Flanders so often and I've never felt the warmth in the Ardennes. It can't just be because it's another hour and a bit's drive. So I wanted to sort of think about what it was about the Ardennes that didn't sort of capture my heart in quite the same way as the races in Flanders. And, well, it was your great idea to contact a man named Patrick McGuinness, an author who wrote a very fine book called Other People's Countries. And he really gets under the skin of the Ardennes and Wallonia in general for me. So,
because he grew up there.
His book is a sort of memoir crossed with a kind of love letter, really, to the town he grew up in Wallonia. And his kind of insight into the place and the people and its place within Belgium is really fascinating. And if anyone's interested...
So now, has it won your heart now? Have you come back smitten?
I think you have to listen to the end of part two of the special to find out.
All right. Okay. Daniel, anything exciting happened to you? Have you fallen in love over the weekend?
No.
Spent a bit of time with Mark Cavendish, though, didn't you?
Yes, I did, actually. He seems to have fallen in love with Mallorca. He was in Mallorca again, training hard. I think he's going to be riding the Tour de Yorkshire this week. And a couple of finishes there that should suit him. Marcel Kittel will also be there. Could be a bit of a showdown.
I was going to make a joke there, but I won't, just on the off chance that Mark Cavendish is listening. Anyway, we're going to be mainly talking about Liège-Bastogne-Liège in this episode, I think. You won't have felt much warmth there, I don't imagine, Lionel. It looked pretty miserable. But we'll hear what you made of that and you know, what happened in the race. I think you spoke to Theo Gegenhardt, who had a very good tour of the Alps in one of Team Sky's last races before they become Team Ineos. And we're going to be returning to the subject of Mathieu van der Poel briefly as well, aren't we?
Mathieu, Richard, we must vow to give him his proper name this week. It's not Mathieu.
I know. I've fallen into that habit of calling him Mathieu.
A lot of people doing it.
Mathieu.
It's Mathieu.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. I'd been trying not to do that, and I did it. I apologize. I'll try better next time. I'm just going to call him van der Poel for the rest of the episode and in the future. And what else? Are we going to look ahead to the Giro a little bit as well?
Why not?
Let's do it. Well, before any of that, can we have the news roundup, please, Lionel?
Yeah, I'll recap what's been going on and off the bike. As you say, it was the Ardennes Classics, Rich, culminating with Liège-Bastogne-Liège, won by Jakob Fuglsang of Astana, continuing Astana's really remarkable spring of results and capping a very fine week for the 34-year-old Dane, because he, a few days earlier, had been second to Julien Alaphilippe at Flèche Wallonne. That was Alaphilippe's second Flèche Wallonne title in a row. And the pair of them were, of course, caught in the finish straight within touching distance almost of the line by the Mathieu van der Poel express train at Amstel Gold a week ago. So Fuglsang near miss, followed by near miss, followed by the biggest victory of his career in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, made his move on the final climb, was chased into the town by Davide Formolo. The big heart-stopping moment was on a very fast descent, which I actually rode myself on Saturday, because Simon, the photographer, and I did the version of the Sportive on Saturday, and that was a tricky enough descent going at the speed we were going on. So a lot of people marvelling at how Fuglsang kept the bike upright when the back wheel flicked out. He was being chased by Davide Formolo of Bora Hansgrohe, who eventually finished second, and Formolo's teammate Max Schachmann finished third. So two men on the podium for Bora Hansgrohe, kind of making up for, I guess, the misfiring performances, the continued misfiring performances of their star rider Peter Sagan, who had a disappointing week, having, we suspect, tried to kind of plan his season around a tilt at Liège-Bastogne-Liège with this new finish in mind. Anyway, we'll talk about that in the race in detail in the first part. The women's races were not available for anybody to watch on TV, so I didn't see an awful lot of either, but I did see Anna van der Breggen cross the line first at the top of the Muir de Huy, her fifth Flèche Wallonne victory in a row. She was ahead of Annemiek van Vleuten. Van Vleuten then won Liège-Bastogne-Liège in very impressive style, winning by a minute and 39 seconds ahead of Flirty Mackay and Demi Vollering to complete an all-Dutch podium. Lizzie Deignan was seventh in Liège, which is her best result. This was her first week back in action following the birth of her daughter last year. You mentioned the Tour of the Alps, Richard. Everyone there, more or less everyone there, will have one eye on the Giro d'Italia that's coming up, I suspect. Theo Gegenhardt of Team Sky got his first two professional wins, finished second overall behind his teammate Pavel Sivakov, who also won a stage. And there were a couple of stage wins for Fausto Masnada, who will be going to the Giro in a couple of weeks' time as well, as will Davide Chimolai of the Israel Cycling Academy, who won two stages in the overall at the Vuelta a Castilla y León in Spain. What else happened at Liège-Bastogne-Liège and Flèche Wallonne? Well, Alejandro Valverde swallowed a bee in the final kilometre of the Muir de Huy, and he pulled out of Liège-Bastogne-Liège after about 100 kilometres, so not a great week for the world champion. Greg Van Avermaet of CCC crashed on the Côte d'Oine. He'd been targeting Liège-Bastogne-Liège at sort of the last minute, really, having added it to his programme. And bad news for Jumbo-Visma, because Robert Hesink is out of the Giro d'Italia, where he was going to be one of the key people for Primoz Roglic, who's going for the overall there. He crashed and has broken his collarbone. It was Team Sky's last race as Team Sky at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Wout Poels was 10th. Not a particularly good result for Team Sky in many of the classics, actually. They will become Team Ineos officially at the Tour de Yorkshire. Still don't quite know what they're going to do at the Tour of Romandy, which starts.
They are Napalm. They're going to be called Team Ineos, and they're wearing some kind of hybrid kit. It's not going to be the permanent kit. It's a twist on their current Sky jersey, but with Ineos, obviously, as the logo.
Interesting.
I understand.
They were pretty tight-lipped about it yesterday at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but they're going to have to rebrand everything, aren't they? The team vehicles and the kit and the casual clothing and everything, but they will be Team Ineos in Yorkshire. We're poised for some environmentalists protesting at the Tour de Yorkshire. The fact that Ineos is a petrochemical company. It's involved in fracking, which is not very popular in areas where fracking takes place. I did ask Dave Brailsford about whether they were anticipating a less than warm welcome there. It didn't seem to really be too concerned at this stage about potential protests, but we shall see what happens at the weekend with that.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa, for their support. Michael Woods of EF Education First rode extremely well at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, if slightly unconventionally, with his one leg warmer kind of outfit. That was
well, they're so good, the Rafa leg warmers, you only need to wear one of them. Is that...
Yeah, that I think you're just that, I think you're doing that. You're they're advertising for them there, Lionel.
Terribly off message or terribly on message? I'm not sure.
I think that sounds great. I mean, he posted a picture on Twitter this morning of himself alongside Flojo back in the day in the 80s when she would wear outfits like that, one leg warmer, one arm warmer. So yeah, it might catch on. You never know. It might catch on. He did ride well, though. Rafa have also just released their Nelson Vales collection. We mentioned this last week. Nelson Vales is the sprinter who was a silver medalist at the LA Olympics in the 1980s and 1984. Also appeared in a Kevin Bacon film, Quicksilver, Racing a Yellow Cab, that had Kevin Bacon inside it. You might remember that. But the new Rafa Nelson Vales collection is out now. It's very striking indeed. Check it out at rafa.cc. Also at rafa.cc and on Velo News, you will find various chapters of the Rafa roadmap. We're probably going to be talking about that at some point over the next few weeks. We're very interested to hear what you think as well. It's Rafa's analysis of all that's going wrong and going right in the world of professional cycling, what needs to change, what needs to stay the same, and what could be better, etc. So four chapters are up on Velo News already, outlining different parts of the sport, how to make it more fan friendly, could teams adopt a franchise model, what could be done to the calendar. You'll also find longer extracts from the Rafa roadmap at rafa.cc, and thanks once again to Rafa for their support of the cycling podcast. So on to Liège-Bastogne-Liège. You were there, Lionel, of course. It was miserable weather, freezing cold. We saw Michael Woods with his one leg warmer, but a lot of riders wrapped up throughout the whole race. A race, though, that, well, we've had some exciting classics this spring. Where did this rank among them? We were sharing some messages, the three of us, as the race was heading towards its closing stages, and there was a lot of anticipation about the new finish. Did it work? Was it an exciting race, or was it similar to editions that we've seen recently, which have tended to be a little bit muted?
A tricky one for me to answer, because I was there with Simon, the photographer, Simon Gill, and we were darting around trying to catch the race in various different places. We saw them on the second climb, the Côte de Saint-Roch, which is down at Houffalize, the first one on the homeward leg, and then we saw them a bit later on the Côte de Stockau, and then we were at the Côte de la Redoute, but we couldn't stop there, so we actually went to the final climb, the Côte de la Roche au Faucon, and I think that the sense was that everything was going to come down to that climb and the run-in, and that's what happened, wasn't it? Being out there and kind of wrapped up, not in the race, obviously, but around the race, and sensing the anticipation of the fans, and lots of people were out despite the really miserable weather, gives perhaps a different sense of the occasion than watching on TV. But just from what I saw watching as the race unfolded on the Eurosport player, it wasn't action-packed, was it? It was, everything was really condensed into that final climb and then the run-in to the finish. And I suppose all it's really done is shifted the decisive moment back down the road 20-odd kilometres. But I think that the one takeaway for me was just how hard the course is and just how hard the conditions made it. The riders coming over, from perhaps the second, third group, after the leaders were really looking pretty shattered. They were just racing to get home, basically, from that point, and they looked like they'd left everything out there. And I think that's one of the things with Liège-Bastogne-Liège, that it's not as visually dramatic, not as spectacular as the Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, which obviously have the cobbles. But I think it's probably the hardest physical test, because the climbs are long, they're steep, they come one after the other, and add in the distance and the fact that the weather was appalling, and it was a really tough day out. And so it's not a real surprise that Jakob Fuglsang, who I've kind of said is a kind of a diesel who perhaps lacks the punch to finish things off, he was really the man who seized the initiative in the crucial part of the race, and challenged anyone to try and get on terms, and no one could. It was an impressive victory. The slip on the descent, again, the road conditions were really treacherous in places, and there were quite a lot of crashes, and just being on the main road that runs parallel to the Côte de Stocco in the sort of middle of the afternoon, and seeing how quickly they were coming down there, and hearing the sort of the squealing and screeching of brakes, watching a few of them sort of hop round the corner, almost back wheels bouncing all over the place. It was a day for bike handling and just kind of grit and determination. And so you can't argue that Fuglsang was not a deserving winner, but was it a kind of a an epic fight, a real kind of clash of the titans on that final climb? It wasn't really, was it? It was a war of attrition, and people fell away once he put the pressure on. What did you think watching it from, 100k out or whatever?
I would agree with you, Napalm. It reminded me a little bit of the World Championship road race last year, similar kind of finale. Maybe that was because the way Alaphilippe ended up riding and ultimately failing to win was very similar, in the sense that he'd been teed up perfectly by his team in Innsbruck, and he was yesterday, and just didn't quite or couldn't quite follow the best riders. But very attritional. I suspect that La Redoute was it was almost neutralised, and it was a bit of an anticlimax. I suspect that had quite a lot to do with the weather, and I think we would have seen a bit more of an aggressive race in the last 40 kilometres had it not been such a stinking day. Fuglsang probably needed a race that hard and that attritional in order to do what he did. It's the kind of race you could have imagined someone like Cadel Evans winning 5 or 10 years ago. He always needed the race to be very, very difficult. And Fuglsang's a similar rider. Having said that, Fuglsang is, to my mind anyway, he's a different rider this year. There's been a remarkable transformation from having been one of the stronger riders in the bunch, certainly one of the best climbers, but without a much of a finishing kick, and not that incisive in his attacks prior to this year. And something's changed. I know he's changed coaches. The coach he was with for a long time was a Dane called Rune Larsen, and he left Astana at the end of last year. And Fuglsang has been working with, I think, the chief coach at Astana, Maurizio Mazzaleni. What the difference is in his training, I'm not quite sure, but it's definitely working.
Fuglsang's been around for a long, long time now, and he was a understudy in a way to the Schlecks, wasn't he, for a number of years, and seemed to be very much trying to follow in their wheel marks and become a Grand Tour rider. And I remember interviewing him many years ago when it was Team Radio Shack and Johan Bruneel had taken over, and he really didn't like Johan Bruneel very much, but you felt that it was a constant battle to try and get as lean as possible, and that was always going to be quite difficult for him. And what's new is this ability that we're seeing in one day races. I mean, he's ridden well in week long stage races this year as well. But I wonder if he's just given up on Grand Tours. I guess we'll find out. I mean, I think he's still going to go to the Tour de France as a leader at Astana, but maybe he's switched his emphasis a bit and is a bit sharper and better in one day races. I don't know, but it'd be fascinating to speak to him about this.
It's interesting, Daniel, what you say about this expectation that the Côte de la Redoute is somehow the springboard, but it's so far from the finish. And although only two categorised climbs between there and the finish, it's up and down all the way. There's no real easy stretches, and I wonder whether sort of our expectations on that climb being the place where the magic happens is perhaps a little unrealistic. I mean, at least we didn't sort of see the same template of race that we've seen in the last, you know, few years, or variations on a theme. It did pose a different set of challenges, and like you say, De Koenig Quickstep looked for a long period like they had everything absolutely sewn up. They were there in numbers, looking good. Alaphilippe obviously didn't have the legs. There's some reports from Fuglsang himself that Alaphilippe said to him, you know, I hope you win today, as you know, which could be interpreted anyway, couldn't it, when you hear these kind of things come out. Maybe it was an elaborate and unsuccessful double bluff. But the thing that struck me most really was the moment when Astana really seized control. They seemed to have nearly everybody still in the race and still able to set a very fast pace to put Fuglsang into a position to get away. And I don't know, the Côte de la Redoute has this sort of almost mythical status, but the only way I can see it being really decisive is if they move the finish sort of 20 kilometres south of Liège, maybe.
Or if they take out some of the climbs. I mean, there are already fewer climbs, I think I'm right in saying, on this new version of the course compared to the previous version. But, you know, it might still be too difficult, the route, ultimately. I mean, I did think that, well, I think it's a better course, personally. Technically, I think it's a better course. I also think that, in a similar way to what we said last week about the Amstel finish and the tweaks to that, I think visually it's more sort of coherent with what is the flavour and what is the image we have or like to have of Liège and of the Ardennes, to go down off La Rochefoucauld through on the kind of wooded descent where Fuglsang almost came off, and to take what was a much nicer route into Liège, a much more aesthetically pleasing route into Liège. I thought that, well, personally, I think that's important, and that was a sort of thumbs up for me.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet reminds me to tell you that this week's episode is supported by The Week. The Week magazine acts as a news filter. It pulls together the best and most interesting articles and opinion from over 200 different sources every week, bringing you multiple points of view on the most important topics so you can be sure you've got the full picture. Best of all, you can actually read less and know more. It's a concise summary of the last week. You have everything you need to know in one quick read. And you can try it for free. We'll tell you in a moment how you get 6 free copies of The Week. But it's not just news. It covers science, sport, food, the arts, and more. It's an anti-echo chamber, an opportunity to challenge yourself with different points of view. And Lionel, you've been challenging yourself with different points of view in your copy of The Week. What have you, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, that's right, Rich. First of all, the Week actually has a bit of a wine club. There's suggestions for some very reasonably priced wines, which I thought you ought to take some notice of ahead of Grand Tour season, perhaps, given your tastes. But no, what I like about The Week is that it gathers stories together from across the spectrum. And on one page, there's something from the Financial Times, the Observer, the Sunday Times, and the New Statesman. Now, I would like to say I'm reasonably well read, but in a given week, I'm unlikely to get through all of those publications. And The Week has basically curated interesting snippets for me. But the one that really caught my eye was actually from the New Statesman. And it says, how Twitter makes fools of our politicians. And having just engaged in a bit of a burst on Twitter over the last 12 hours or so, my cheeks flush slightly red because Ian Leslie writes that the law of Twitter is simple. The more frequently serious people tweet, the less seriously we take them. Twitter can increase a person's fame, but never their authority. And this is in response to politicians who have basically taken to almost live tweeting their thoughts on, you know, just about every issue from, you know, across the spectrum of society and beyond. And perhaps the lesson there is, you know, less is more.
Interesting. It applies to sports people as well. It certainly can erode the mystique around somebody, which in the cycling, which we cover, and politics, where trust it has been low. Perhaps that sort of transparency can be a good thing. But I totally take that point. Yes, well, join 350,000 people who trust The Week as their essential curated news source. Try it for yourself with your first six issues completely free if you listen to the Cycling Podcast. Visit theweek.co.uk/offer, then use the offer code cycling. That's theweek.co.uk/offer and use the offer code cycling to get six free issues.
Well, Victory capped a really impressive week for Fuglsang. A week ago were sort of suggesting that, Julian Alaphilippe's problem was that in 9 times out of 10, he would beat Fuglsang in a sprint. Then Fuglsang himself said he was pleasantly surprised by how well he rode at Flèche Wallonne, and I think this bears out what you're saying, Daniel, that race has been made significantly more difficult with the inclusion of a number of climbs on this new loop that they go round. It's not just all about the Mur de Huy. It certainly wasn't last week. And that really whittled the group down the second time up the Mur de Huy. And Fuglsang, you know, it took out a lot of the other factors for him, and just meant that the kind of the toughest all graduated to the top, and he was in a group that perhaps in another year he might not have had the scrapping or climbing power to make his way to the front up that climb. But he was there, you know, not particularly close to Alaphilippe really, but closest of everyone. And then just that toughness, I think, just seeing them come over the top of the last climb. And I mean, it's easy to say now in hindsight as he's won it, but of all of the sort of first 20, 30 riders over the top, Fuglsang looked like he was the most, you know, had it under control the most. There were some people that really were sort of grinding over the line at the top, and looking for a bit of a breather on the descent, whereas he, and to be fair, the others right at the sharp end were putting the pressure on. And it was, yeah, an impressive performance, but the conditions really all played into his hands, I think.
Lionel, you mentioned Astana and how they, you know, took such a firm grip of the race. And, you know, for me, the podium and the top four just bear out what's a pattern of this season, which has been the total domination of a few teams. You know, Astana being one of them, Bora Hansgrohe with two men on the podium, and then Mitchelton Scott with Adam Yates fourth. Those have been the dominant teams. De Koenig, Quickstep are the other one, of course. But those four teams have really, to an extent that I can't remember in previous years, won just about everything. And not just with one or two riders, but with, and certainly in Bora Hansgrohe's case, quite a collection of riders. And you mentioned that Sagan was the guy who, you know, we imagined a few weeks ago would be leading the team into this race. You know, he's had a poor spring, but they haven't needed him because the others have been performing so well. And it's, I don't know if this strikes you as different and new, but, you know, those teams, Astana, Bora Hansgrohe, Mitchelton Scott and De Koenig Quickstep, just kind of sweeping all before them.
No, I think an honourable mention for Jumbo-Visma as well, or you know, more to the point, Primoz Roglic, who's won a couple of stage races, and Dylan Groenewegen, who's won a couple of sprints. But you're right; it's gone in these little clutches of victories for certain teams, and I don't really know what you can put that down to. Really, I mean, De Koenig Quickstep, obviously, as Quickstep last year, were winning about the same rate. It's really the emergence to rival them of Bora Hansgrohe and Astana this spring that has jumped out, hasn't it? The Yates brothers have been doing very well in stage races for, you know, best part of 2 years really now, just getting better and more consistent results. But you're right, it's almost like four teams are sharing the spoils amongst themselves, and everybody else is sort of playing for the, you know, not even the minor places in some races. I don't really know what to put that down to, and I felt kind of a bit sorry for Lotto Soudal in a way yesterday, because they tried their utmost, and Tim Wellens was looking good at one point, but under the pressure of the usual suspects, you know, that all kind of melted away all too easily. But As to what the answer, what the reason for that is, I'm not too sure. Have you got any clues, Daniel?
Well, it's quite surprising as well that if you look at most sort of team sports across the sort of spectrum of professional sports, that where there is no salary cap and there's no sort of break on wealth sort of correlating or transferring into success, that is happening, that there is a real concentration of the richest teams, and that the gulf that exists between the richest teams and the poorest teams in most team sports is widening, you know, as you know, it is, you might say, in society, between the rich and the poor. It's a phenomenon you sort of see across lots of different domains. However, in professional cycling, that is not necessarily, well, it's certainly what we have seen in certain types of races over the last few years, and with Team Sky dominating major tours, for example. But at the start of this season, if you look at this particular phenomenon, this season, it's not necessarily the case. I mean, Astana, Bora Hansgrohe, Mitchelton Scott and De Koninck Quickstep are not the four richest teams in the peloton. And the teams, similarly, the teams who in equally glaring fashion are really, really struggling. Katusha Alpecin, Dimension Data, Bahrain Merida have not had a particularly good couple of months. And they're not necessarily the absolute poorest teams either, so there must be something else.
It's curious. Yeah, I mean, as you say, the underperformance in some teams across the board is as striking as the what you could call the overperformance in some teams. You know, Astana, if you looked at their lineup at the start of the year, you would have said it was solid, but not capable of, or not likely to dominate in the way that they kind of have. It's been interesting. And Bora Hansgrohe, another one that really stand out. You know, Mitchelton Scott, quite dependent on the Yates brothers, obviously. But yeah, it's been a fascinating thing to look at and to try and understand what's going on.
Is it not a kind of a also a consequence of how difficult or how time consuming it is to evolve a team? It's not like you know, there's not a sort of mid-season transfer window where you can sort of get rid of a few and bring a few more in like you can in football, or teams do make changes in, you know, in the off season obviously, but you generally see a small handful of riders go and a small handful of riders come in, and it perhaps takes a while for teams to reach a point where they've got a lineup that can compete across a number of different landscapes. And Astana have kind of got that, and I suppose that just highlights just how Fuglsang has sort of turned himself into a one-day rider to a great degree, although I have to remember he was a silver medalist at the Olympic Games in 2016, but really the greatest results of his career so far had been in stage races, shorter stage races, kind of a B movie version of a Grand Tour rider rather than a classic specialist. And I think your point, Richard, is interesting. Maybe it's at the age of 34 a decision to kind of move away from that and concentrate, or try to concentrate on something slightly different, as led to the results that he's got this spring, because it does look like he set out on a path, and now with the benefit of hindsight, looking back even just to Strada Bianca and the fact that he was good there, and he's been good you know, every step from there to this weekend, it looks like, it's easy to say because it's happened, but it looks like that was the plan all along.
Who knows? Before we move on, Lionel, you, when you were away, just to return to Matthew van der Poel, because you know, he's the one that's broken those teams' stranglehold on some of the big races, Amstel Gold Race in particular. We spoke about him a lot last week and about the Amstel Gold Race and where that stood or where it fitted in, because a lot of people were hailing that as a, you know, a race that was won for the, you know, one for the books, as one of the great races, certainly one of the most exciting finishes that we've seen. And we spoke a bit about van der Poel last week and about whether, you know, we had seen him coming, seen his emergence, seen the potential for him to win a race like Amstel Gold Race against some of the best road riders in the world. I think you spoke about him to a couple of Dutch sports directors on your travels.
I did, yeah. Obviously, arriving at Flesh Wallonne on Wednesday, a few days after Amstel Gold, and went first to the Jumbo-Visma team bus and spoke to Addy Engels, their sports director. Of course, Jumbo-Visma have got Wout van Aert, another cyclocross sensation who's crossed across to the road, and had less impressive results than Van der Poel this spring, of course. And then I spoke to Eike Visbeek, who is Dutch, the boss of Team Sunweb, which, although a German registered team, it's a team with a strong Dutch character. And obviously, they wouldn't be drawn on, you know, they're not going to admit, oh, yes, we'd be interested in signing Van der Poel. But I was interested to get their perspective on whether they'd seen this coming, what they made of the performance, and where they see Van der Poel going from here.
Phenomenal. What I saw this spring is incredible talent.
Did it surprise you at all, the way that he won on Sunday?
Yes. Yes. I think I'm not the only one. I mean, the way where he came from in the final, I think nobody expected him to win until the last few hundred meters. It makes it even more impressive.
You have Wout van Aert on your team, of course, so can you put into context and maybe compare the two? Is there any comparison, or is Van der Poel on a different level?
I don't think it's very useful to do comparisons like that, to do comparisons anyway. I mean, every race, the only comparison we make between the riders, it's not a comparison we make, it's a comparison that's being made in the race, and it's in the end, it's the result. I think the thing is they have in common is they are both great talents, and they come from the same discipline. That's what they have in common. But I think that's the most important thing, to realize they are both exceptional talents, and I think they would do great in any sport. They have the little thing, or maybe it's not a little thing, but it's a special thing they have.
When you see Van der Poel moving around in the bunch and Wout as well, do you notice the little things from cyclocross that gives them something extra in the peloton?
To be honest, I don't see that much handling of them we are driving behind. I see the most when I'm at home watching television, and that's not too much, but I think sometimes you see these little things, you know, like on social media, call it tricks, call it like bike handling. For sure they show they are capable of, but they show it also in the winter. I mean, that's the thing, that's for sure. They know how to handle the bike. But there's a lot of professional cyclists who know how to handle their bike as well. So that's...
Lastly, you're a big Dutch team. He's a big Dutch talent. You're going to be asked this, I'm sure. You know, what will Mathieu van der Poel's future be? Currently, he's on a small team, and he has some different objectives, mountain biking, cyclocross, as well as the road. But where do you see his future, and what do you think he could achieve?
I really don't know. I really don't know. I think he has been quite clear the last week, saying wanting to respect his contract, which is still a few years. So I can't predict what he's going to do. I couldn't predict this spring for him. So I also can't predict what's coming next for him.
It was an impressive performance by him. That it was a chaotic final, which definitely favoured the chasers, because the two attackers did not know what the gap was, and that was for everybody, also the chasers. And I think this is, for us, it was an example of you never give up on finals like this, and we use that in a positive way also in a meeting today. I mean, he's the Dutch champion, road champion. And he crushed there the whole Dutch pro field by attacking and still in the end winning the sprint. And so I'm not surprised, but still I'm surprised that he actually could win three classics. And but I'm not surprised about his level. He has been an absolutely world-class talent already at a young age. He's been training also a lot. So I'm not in that sense, I'm not surprised he was going to be a major player in the Classics.
What do you think his future is going to be? Because he's with a small team and he has different objectives, mountain biking, cyclocross, as well as the road. It looks a very specific journey for him. He's not currently in a World Tour team, but people presumably are going to be very interested in trying to take him from Corendon Circus, do you think?
Yeah, but I mean, I think what will be a new aspect for him is that he will now be one of the favourites next spring. That will bring more expectations and will not always be nice. I mean, we could see that, for example, with Michael here in Amstel Gold Races, that still there were not a hell of a lot of riders that wanted to ride with him in the final. And I think that is something that Mathieu van der Poel will also face. So, and of course, the steps, I mean, he will not surprise everybody next year. So to have the same feeling when everything goes your way in the Classics, that's difficult. So it will come with a new set of challenges for him.
And as a Dutchman, what do you think his emergence does for Dutch cycling?
Well, I mean, we saw that in Amstel Gold Race Sunday. I mean, the crowd exploded, and I think it's a very good story, and I think it just brings more enthusiasm to the Dutch crowd. I mean, we had the luck, of course, with Nicky Terpstra crashing out, and then Mathieu emerged. And we are in a luxury position with Dutch cycling that we have several stars, and I think the attitude that Mathieu has towards racing, I think it doesn't only appeal to the Dutch audience, but I think it appeals to a lot of people internationally.
And lastly, would you be interested in signing him? Would you get the checkbook out to try to prize him away?
I mean, I think any director sportif that would say who don't want to have a Mathieu van der Poel on the team is lying. But it's of course much more complicated than that. And I think the team, the management has to look what are the opportunities. But what I heard is that he has a several-year contract, and that normally means that we have the courtesy of not bothering these riders.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now we've got another question for Science in Sport from a listener, Ian Brown from Wiltshire. Thanks for your question, Ian. The question is about fueling during longer endurance events. After 3 hours in an endurance event, I've had enough of sweet-tasting products, be them drinks, gels, or bars. Not yet nauseous, but no desire to consume anything else sweet. What strategy would you recommend for someone who just doesn't have a great tolerance for sweet products? Kind regards from Ian Brown. That's a question for Ben Samuels at Science and Sport.
Hi, Ian. It's a good point, and you won't be on your own with this one for sure. The priority with fueling is to maintain that steady supply of carbohydrate to the working muscle, to be used as energy and fuel performance. How we do this practically can be flexible to suit your preferences. I'd suggest you look at an intensity-based options when planning out a ride, using more whole foods during lower intensity periods on the bike, and then switching to gels or drinks when the intensity rises, and so too the demands of performance. That's going to support performance overall and promote stomach comfort with eating on the bike. It's also going to include savoury options to meet your taste preferences. Things like homemade rice cakes, sandwiches and bars can all be adapted to more savoury type flavours, leaving those sweeter sports nutrition options for when you really need them. In that way, you're going to meet your individual taste preferences while still feeding little and often to support performance on the bike.
Thank you, Ben, and please keep your questions coming. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. If you have a question about sports nutrition, either your own or the pros, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Well, the Giro is almost upon us, and I have been mentioning for a couple of weeks now these limited edition mugs that we are producing with a ceramicist in the States, Stacey Snyder, who we've known for a few years as a podcast listener, sent me a mug a few years ago, and they are absolutely beautiful, almost like ornaments rather than drinking vessels, but I love my mug. And she's made these or designed these beautiful Giro Cycling Podcast mugs, which will be available during the Giro. They will be for sale at $40, which is her standard retail price. Postage will be on top of that, and we'll be able to advise how much postage costs, depending on where you live, of course. Seems to have been quite a lot of interest already in the cups. We'll be producing more at the Tour de France, more at the Vuelta. And all the proceeds, which is 50% of that cost, will go to a good cause. We've had a lot of nominations for good causes, and I can already tell that one of the most difficult things of the year is going to be not so much choosing a good cause, but declining others, because there are some really great cases being made for cycling clubs, events, initiatives, funds, trusts, and keep them coming. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. That's contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. If you'd like to nominate a good cause, we'll be doing a different good cause at the Tour de France and another one at the Vuelta, so there'll be another chance if your good cause is not selected this time. We'll be announcing the good cause in next week's podcast, so the three of us will put our heads together over the next week. But get your nomination in this week for consideration, please. And we'll tell you exactly next week how you buy one of these beautiful mugs.
Talking of next week's podcast, Rich, we're hoping that it's going to be a Giro d'Italia themed press conference issue, where the listeners send in questions for the three of us to answer. But in the great tradition of cycling press conferences of yore, we've basically given misleading information about how to pose a question. It's the equivalent of saying that the press conference will happen at 10 o'clock and then holding it at 9 o'clock. And everyone missing it, because I don't understand how WhatsApp works. I'm just not very bright, and you can't just dial the number that I said dial. You have to record a message on your phone and then send it via WhatsApp to the number which is in our Twitter bio, but it's +44 7971 338 205. Keep your questions tight, please, under a minute. A few people have worked out how to get us a question, but we need a lot more questions to make an episode. So do please think of something you want to ask us about the Giro. It can be anything about the route, about the history, who's going to win, who's not going to win, what we're looking forward to most, and so on. Try and trip Daniel up with his Italian expertise if you can, or email a question if you don't want your to appear in the podcast. You can email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. any Giro themed questions, or any questions really about the season so far, send them in as an audio message on WhatsApp. I can sense people can tell I still don't really understand how this works, but this is how it's been explained to me, so just please ask us some questions, please.
Yeah, it's not that complicated. And just before we move on to talk a bit about the Tour of the Alps, your friend Special's coming out this week, Lionel, on the Ardennes.
You know, if I still had a dog in the race and I still considered myself to have a view on what Belgium should become, I would say that it doesn't seem to be much point in going independent, given that they already are. They really already are, and you can tell this, I'm sure, just from going from Flanders into Wallonia, or, you know, taking a train ride or a long cycle ride. It's two different countries.
There's a distinct line, a border between Flanders and Wallonia, and we are in the French-speaking bit, Wallonia, for Flesh Wallon, the Walloon Arrow. And it's called the Walloon Arrow because back in the day when the race first started, it used to go from place to place in a sort of arrow shape. I suppose it should be renamed now the Walloon Squiggle, because the course goes from Ons, suburb of Liège, and it finishes in Huy, on the famous Mur de Huy, the Wall of Huy. As Daniel describes the sprint finish, a sort of uphill cheese roll, because it's very steep, sort of slow motion sprint finish on the Mur de Huy. But already it feels very different to Flanders, doesn't it? I don't want to be too unkind, but it doesn't feel as rich or as prosperous, really.
Daniel, yours came out last week, Marco Haller. and Bernie Eisel and their recovery from injury, following them over the last year. That was a fascinating listen, and that's available to listen if you're a friend of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com, and it's £15. If you pay a bit more than that, you can submit an idea for a friend's special and guest edit it perhaps later in the year. So thank you very much, everybody, for your support of the Cycling Podcast. Now, the Tour of the Alps. We saw Vincenzo Nibali sort of honing his Giro preparation there. It was a fascinating race in a way, but it was a thinnish field, wasn't it? It was a much needed series of wins for Team Sky, thanks to Theo Gegenhardt and Pavel Sivakov, and a real sense that those two riders, and Egan Bernal, of course, Ivan Sosa, are going to be the core of what will be Team Ineos in the coming years. But what did we learn from the Tour of the Alps? We learned that Sivakov and Theo Gegenhardt are great talents and future prospects. And what did we learn there, Daniel, about Nibali?
Well, I think he's going better, and his team have said this as well. His coach, they've said that he's going better before a Grand Tour than any point really in the last few years. Is that a good sign? Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, because the Giro this year has quite a soft start by Giro standards. Not a lot is going to happen in the first week as far as the general classification is concerned, apart from the first time trial up the San Luca climb in Bologna. Then we're going to see the sprinters really hold sway for a few days. So Nibali, if he is really hitting top form now, and he's going to have to hold it for a decent amount of time, are his attacks going to be incisive enough? And it really depends on the rivals, doesn't it? If Simon Yates is as strong as he is last year and can eke out another 3 or 4 days at that level, then I think it will be pretty hard for Nibali. And then, we don't really know what kind of form Primoz Roglic is in. He's been at altitude, and we're going to see him at Romandy this week, get a better idea there. Dumoulin was in the shake-up, wasn't he, for most of the race at Liège, but then faded in the closing stages. And Dumoulin's going to be interesting to watch at the Giro, because I think he's a lot of people's favourite, but he's really staking everything on the time trials, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on him in those two longer individual time trials in particular. And we've seen this year that a change of team and a change of equipment for time trialists with real pedigree, people like Rowan Dennis, can be quite problematic. And that's been the case for Dumoulin this year. He's on a new bike. He hasn't ridden a lot of time trials so far this year. So it's going to be intriguing.
Well, and I mentioned Theo Gegenhardt and Pavel Sivakov, both riding the Giro in support of Egan Bernal. Ivan Sosa also riding there. So a sense that could be the Ineos Tour de France team next year and beyond. Who knows? But they had a cracking week anyway at the Tour of the Alps. Two wins for Gegenhardt, a stage win for Sivakov, and the overall, just 21 years old, looks pretty accomplished. I mean, we spoke to Sivakov last year at the Vuelta, and there's an interview with him there on the day that he actually packed that race, didn't finish. He'd had a nasty crash and seemed a bit out of sorts, but he didn't seem out of sorts at the Tour of the Alps. He was really, really impressive, I thought. And Lionel, Theo Gegenhardt went straight from Italy to Liège and rode Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and I think you spoke to him there.
I did indeed. You say he's in the Giro team. We think he's in the Giro team, and I don't think it would be a surprise if he isn't. But he officially doesn't know that, and declined to say that he was in until he's definitely in. But I think it's fairly safe to say that he will be. But his first professional win followed very quickly by his second professional win. So I asked him how it had been, admitting at the start that I'd been in Belgium, so I hadn't actually seen any of the race.
There's always an excuse, eh? Or a premiership match or something. Definitely happy to get some wins on the board, I think. Yeah, I always remember when I was last year on the 23, Rod Ellingworth told me it's really important to win races, if that's what you want to be a big rider, you have to do that. So it's good to start that, I think. But yeah, there's been some other good weeks in the past, so I don't know. It's always different. You have different roles and different expectations, and yeah, it was good.
Is it fair to say quite difficult for you to manoeuvre into a position where you've got the opportunity for yourself because you've done so much work in stage races for others? But was it a case of being given the responsibility this week?
Yeah, not given, no, but seizing, I think, and having some self-confidence to just chase it a bit, and also having the perspective to see the opportunity was there and make sure I didn't miss it, because that's a big one. You can always, it's always possible to take a chance away from yourself by maybe pulling when you don't need to or sacrificing in a moment where it's not quite necessary, but often it is, but there's the odd occasion it's not, so it's about finding that. But yeah, you know, when you see Arsenal lose twice in a week, you have to do something. So yeah, sorry for you yesterday.
No, I'm with you on that, but we're in the FA Cup final, so I'll take
yeah, we see how that goes.
Well, okay, in terms of, you know, getting the job done, you know, this team is all about kind of GC. Winning stages is obviously fantastic, but to also have the focus to stick to the biggest prize of the week as well, that balancing that up can't have been easy, because you were doing bits of both, I gather, racing for yourself but also trying to protect for Pavel.
Yeah, definitely. I think stage three we maybe, yeah, okay, you can never say you got the balance wrong because we kept the lead, but we could have probably won the stage if we just were a little bit, changed the tactic tiny bit, but that's bike racing. And the next day was really satisfying to pull the more or less the whole final, closing down Nibali on the long climb, again on the short climb, close down Rafa and then still win the sprint. That was pretty awesome to be able to do both. It's not often you can do that, but when it's a four-man group and there's two of you, it makes it maybe a tiny, tiny bit easier. And yeah, for sure, we had the legs, which in the end is the main thing.
Makes you feel good for the Giro?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm selected yet, so maybe you can tell me, but no, we'll see. Still a few weeks, but in the end, I'm focusing on today for now. You know, it's the biggest race of the year, so focus on today, and then yeah, what comes just starts tomorrow, really.
So that was Theo Gegenhardt speaking to Lionel at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and he was in the thick of things until pretty late on at Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well. I had somebody tweeted me a picture of Theo Gegenhardt, because I tweeted, and this is going back to Fuglsang and Liège, I suggested that with Fuglsang's victory this year following Bob Jungels last year, that you don't necessarily need magnificent hair to win at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but it definitely helps. And somebody suggested that Theo Gegenhardt, with his bouffant hair, could be a future contender. Daniel, I've copied you. I don't know if you've done this, but someone again suggested that in response to this, 18 best hairstyles in cycling.
I need more time to prepare this, Rich. This
I've done it.
Oh, have you?
I've done it, Daniel. Am I allowed to?
Go on, then.
This isn't copyrighted or anything.
Go on.
Okay. In the manner and the style of Daniel, I'm going to do this very quickly and not publish it. Anquetil, Coppi, Merckx, Cerrone, Froehler, Eno, Van der Aarden, Tunisa, Elliott, Malcolm, that is, Cipollini, De Leon, Pozzato, Cancellara, Sagan, Jungels, Fuglsang, Kittel, Oss.
Well, that list is worthless, because
heavily weighted towards contemporary riders, of
course. There's no
Uchikov. Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, okay, that's an omission.
I
don't think it makes it worthless, does it?
Well,
it should be a list of...
I need another 16 names, but so far I've got Rhys, Pantani...
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Anyone else? Armand de las Cuevas. I think he was basically quite shiny on top, wasn't he? Anyone else?
Yeah.
Sending him.
Piepoli, John Gadray, Luca Gelfi.
Bettini was kind of heading that way. Valverde. Lionel's alternative list of the best hairstyles in cycling. I like it.
Oh, well.
Well, I'm sure that'll get a lot of reaction. We'll return to one of... You haven't got 18 riders to watch at the Tour de Yorkshire, have you, Lionel? Daniel, sorry.
No, alas, I have not. I have not.
But that exciting feature will return, though, before the Giro, won't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I might come up with something. It might not be 18 riders most likely to win at the Giro. It might be something else.
What about 18 potential stage winners at the Giro?
Italian, 18 Italian verbs to teach Lionel before the first time trial. Something along those
lines. Wow. Wow. That's going to be tough. Are we looking forward to the Giro? It's next week. You've got the Tour de Yorkshire before then, Daniel. Is that your little sort of warm-up?
Yes, very much looking forward to the Giro, Rich. A few days between Yorkshire and the Giro. Particularly looking forward to the opening weekend and that time trial up the San Luca climb in Bologna is going to be very spectacular to watch, I think.
Who's going to win the Giro?
The way Astana are going.
It's a hard one to call, isn't it? It's a hard one to call.
The way Astana are riding, I wouldn't put it past Superman to win the Giro.
Even with the time trials?
Well, he's out in, he's been in Colombia preparing, I understand. And, well, the first time trial is going to suit him pretty well.
Yeah.
And even the second time trial, San Marino, is not for pure roulers. So I think the route might suit him fairly well.
I think we'll have more of a clue after Romandy, won't we? I mean, not that it's going to, definitively shape the Daniel's top 18, but we will get more of a clue as to who's going to be going in good shape anyway. Too early to say, isn't it?
It's a really, I can't really remember a Grand Tour where you look at it and you can't, Dumoulin, Roglic, Yates, can't really see them not finishing on the podium, but then Bernal and, as you say, Lopez and,
Superman.
Nibali. Yeah, sorry. Nibali, well, yeah, maybe. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. Looking forward to it. We're all going to be in Bologna for the opening weekend together. We should say, of course, confirm that daily coverage of the Giro d'Italia will be available as ever. And we'll also be producing Kilometer Zero at the Giro d'Italia. 3 episodes a week, 9 episodes in total. Next week we'll be revealing the sponsor for Kilometer Zero, to whom we are very grateful, of course. And it's exciting. It's almost upon us. So bring it on, the Giro. Shall we wrap things up for this week?
Yes.
Before we do, can we say our thank yous to some of those who've signed up as friends of the podcast? Lionel, can you kick that off?
Yeah, a big thank you to Joel Smith, Christopher Murray, David Warner, Peter Francis, David Riggs, and Jane Kirkpatrick for your support. Makes a big difference to us. Thank you.
A big thank you to Barry Zelma, Ben Cady, Ben Houston, Keith Morrell, Jason Remale, Jeff Skeels.
And a big thank you to Stephen Lewis, Stephen O'Callaghan, Matthew Lawrence, Andy Folks, Daniel Ernst, and Amanda Gibson. Thank you very much to all of you for signing up as a friend of the podcast. And thank you to you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Finally, and just before we go, if you are waiting for the 6th and final Adam Blythe interview in our little mini-series that we've been running, it is coming. Unfortunately, the interview that Adam did for last week had a technical glitch and we couldn't release it. He's off to ride the Tour de Romandie this week. That takes priority, obviously, but doing a final interview for the Cycling Podcast is a very close second. So it is coming and we hope to release it imminently.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.